23 for Dr. Suzanne Marshall on Dr. Barbara Hanna. Okay, where or when do you first remember hearing of AIDS or HIV infection or the beginnings thereof?
I was an infectious disease physician in New Orleans on the faculty of Tulane in the early 80s, and the first I really heard about the disease was when I got a phone call from a friend who was a physician in New York asking me if we had seen any patients with pneumocystis pneumonia or Kaposi's sarcoma. I didn't even know what Kaposi's sarcoma was, so I knew I hadn't seen that. I was a little bit worried I might have missed a patient with pneumocystis, but I didn't really think we had seen anything that even could remotely have been that. So I told him no, and he said that they had had several homosexual patients with one of those two disorders, and they were trying to find out if anybody had noted that in any other city around the country. And so they were calling people that they knew in places with sizable gay populations. That was the first I heard of it. Shortly after that, there was the initial article published in the MMWR reporting the cases in Los Angeles. At that time, people were calling it by a variety of names, but I think probably GRID was the big thing. We didn't see our first cases in New Orleans until mid-82.
Pretty early on in the disease, or...?
Well, I mean, certainly we weren't the first city to experience cases, and we had a little bit of information from some of the coastal cities, but it was still fairly early in the epidemic. There wasn't much information available. The first patients I saw were gay males with unexplained lymphadenopathy, and nobody really knew what that meant. A few months later, I began to see patients with pneumocystis pneumonia, patients who were obviously ill. Most of the patients with the lymphadenopathy were not ill, they were just scared. And within probably 4 months, there was a big change in my practice because of this new disease, which turned out to be HIV infection. Before HIV infection, infectious diseases was largely a consultative service. I didn't have a clinic or anything that I operated because I didn't see enough outpatients to really warrant it. I did have a few hours a week where I could see outpatients at Tulane, but at the two other hospitals where I worked, at the Charity and the VA, we didn't have an outpatient clinic. We just didn't need it. We saw patients when they were admitted to the hospital, mostly as a consulting physician, and generally speaking, by the time they were discharged, their infection was resolving or they had died, but they really didn't have an ongoing problem that required me to follow them. But with HIV infection, that was very different. And, there wasn't very much known about the disease in the early 80s. There certainly wasn't much treatment available. There was a lot of fear. A lot of people didn't want to see them. And I began very quickly to have a lot of outpatients who were coming in for evaluation. And they wanted to know why their lymph nodes were swollen. Did they have this disease? What was going to happen to them? You know, you're sort of going, I don't know. And then also seeing a lot of patients who were ill. And we got reasonably comfortable fairly early with diagnosing pneumocystis. I mean, I think I would probably have missed the first few cases had I not had at least some warning, because it's a hard disease to diagnose in that you can't find the organisms easily in the sputum. So you had to do more invasive procedures, but we were prepared at least enough to know to do those procedures quickly. When I finished my fellowship in infectious disease, there were two illnesses I never wanted to see. One of them was herpes encephalitis, and the other one was pneumocystis pneumonia. The reasons I didn't want to see them were because you had to call somebody else in and convince them to go and do a biopsy, either a brain biopsy or a lung biopsy, fairly quickly in order to make the diagnosis. And I always thought that was difficult to do as quickly as you would like, and so I just hoped I would never see either of those diseases. And of course I didn't see a lot of herpes encephalitis, although I did see some, but rapidly saw a lot of pneumocystis and then learned kind of quickly how to identify it on the stains that I could do quickly in the laboratory. It was a real change for me in the kind of work I had been doing, because the people that were coming in that were sick and were dying were young people. In infectious disease, usually you can treat them and make them better, you know, but with this disease, you treat them and you'd make them better, and then they'd get sick again before you could turn around. You know, we just didn't know a lot about handling that. And I think it was very frustrating early on.
Was it when the beginning stages, was there a lot of, you know, death? Did death occur pretty, was it pretty rapid? Because like today, there are ways of delaying the disease or slowing it down, sort of. Were there, I mean, when a patient found out in the early days, did they go pretty rapidly or?
Well, of course, you didn't have HIV testing in the first few years. And so it was harder to identify the infected patients. And for many people, there was a lot of denial. You know, it was like, well, you know, this is a disease that just isn't going to happen to me, or this just couldn't be happening. I think there was a lot of feeling in the medical community and in the community at large that we just could not be having an epidemic. Mm-hmm. It was impossible for a new disease to come along that would be this deadly and would be... and that we couldn't do anything about. You know, I mean, this is the 20th century. And there was a lot of denial on the part of the patients, you know. I could not have this disease. And so they would come in often very sick and have had, you know, several weeks of fever and increasing shortness of breath and cough and everything, and yet not come to a physician. If they came to a physician, a lot of physicians would deny that this could possibly be this new disease and would treat them for bronchitis, just like everybody else. And of course, they didn't get better with that kind of treatment. So they did come in at what we would now consider late-stage disease for the most part. And they would die within a matter of months. If you saw a patient with pneumocystis pneumonia, the chances were about 85% that you could get them over that. But then the chance was that they would probably be dead within 9 months. Now, we don't see nearly as many patients with pneumocystis pneumonia. And because of all the things we do earlier to intervene, the disease is somewhat different. I don't know if patients live overall longer, but it seems as if they do, simply because we follow them so much longer and we are aware of where they are in their disease progression. Initially, you know, we didn't know to do T4 counts and things like that, so we didn't.
Was it common in the beginning stages, because like in the movie and the band played on, a lot of the early patients were getting diseases that were just not necessarily normal, but this shouldn't be killing somebody, you know. It was just like a lot of the infections were not, you know, what you'd expect a human being to have. You know, there were infections that some of them had not seen, you know.
Well, I think they were weird infections. I mean, that was the real striking thing. And in fact, initially, you know, you really couldn't define a patient as having AIDS unless they had something really weird. They just wouldn't accept that as part of the definition because they didn't want to include a lot of cases that weren't this disease. So, I mean, I never saw a patient with pneumocystis pneumonia before HIV infection. And I had been practicing infectious disease for several years and had done a fellowship at charity and all, and I had seen most diseases, but I had not seen any of that. I had not seen a patient with a toxoplasma brain abscess before. And in fact, the first patient that I saw that had toxoplasmosis was kind of striking because it gives you what we call a brain abscess, but it looks more like a tumor when you do the x-rays and everything. And so the neurosurgeons were operating on this patient because they thought he had a brain tumor and he had started having seizures. And nobody had asked him anything about his sexual preferences or any other diseases he had or weight loss or anything like that. They were just going to take this tumor out. And while he was in the hospital waiting for the surgery, he had some blood drawn. One of the pathologists in the lab was doing a study on T4 cell counts in patients with hepatitis, and he needed some blood for a control specimen. So he picked up this patient's tube of blood, and it said brain tumor, and he thought, well, that's a pretty good control. That's not hepatitis. And so he did his T4 count as a control, and the hepatitis patients all came back with pretty good T4 counts, and this patient came back with a really, really low T4 count. So the pathologist then didn't know what to do. He had this lab data, but he hadn't been asked to see the patient. He didn't know anything about the patient. He didn't really want to intrude. But one of the medical students that was working with him said, well, I'll just go put a little note on the chart. So the medical student came by and wrote a little cryptic note on the chart saying, patient's T4 count is very low. Signed it and left. The patient went on to surgery, and when they resected what was supposed to be this brain tumor and they looked at it in the lab, they realized that it wasn't, and the pathologist told them that it was toxoplasmosis, and the neurosurgeon got very upset and called the pathologist a liar. And then they called me, and I said, well, I don't really think he would make up seeing an organism, you know. So I got to tracking back a little bit and found this note in the chart and traced down why they had done a T4 count on him. And then learned that they had had all kinds of breaks in technique in the operating room and in the laboratory, and a bunch of people had been exposed to this patient's specimen, which caused a lot of concern, because again, we didn't know how easy it was to transmit this disease at this time.
Because of being a woman in what would technically be considered, or not really technically considered, a male profession, but a pretty well dominated profession by men, did you ever experience a lot of difficulty in, you know, reaching a certain level, or did you ever feel that you were discriminated against because you were a woman or not taken as seriously as a man would be?
Well, I think that, you know, if you look back a ways, I went to a women's college, and so medical school was something of a culture shock because there were, in a class of 130, there were only 13 women. And there were discrimination, I guess, in a sense, because we didn't have separate sleeping quarters or anything like that, which in on-call rooms where you may have, you know, six or eight people sleeping is uncomfortable. There's no question about it. It's uncomfortable for both the men and the women, I think. But I didn't feel particularly discriminated against. I just thought that, you know, they hadn't had many women in the program before, and it was expensive to donate, you know, a whole lot of rooms to on-call rooms. And they had other uses for the rooms. So, So I don't know that I really thought they were discriminating against me, you know. They weren't particularly tuned to our needs, perhaps, but it was, I felt it was more that. There were occasional professors that I thought probably just didn't like women, and really didn't want us in the profession. I remember one of my interviewers when I was applying to medical school asked me what I would do if my child was very sick and I needed to be with the child, and I had a patient that was very sick and needed me also. I said, well, what would you do? You know, you can have children too, you know. And